For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay. If you're here for the Skeptics Challenge, my name is Doug Pollack, and if you'd go ahead and start moving to find a seat, we're going to go ahead and jump in here and get started. What a privilege it is for me to be back here. I don't know if this is the sixth, seventh, or eighth year I've been here, and I always love coming to this place. And I love the topic, love what's been talked about. And as I thought about the topic this year, I said to myself, and I said to some of the leadership here, hey, you know, I think to really keep this real, I mean, it's one thing to talk about people like atheists, but how about if we just invited some real people who hold that worldview to join us on the stage so we can have a real conversation? And in a few minutes, I'll be introducing a couple of gentlemen who have agreed to come here today and be part of that real conversation. And the way I went about this, I actually put it out on Craigslist and said atheist wanted, and I had a guy respond, and we had a great conversation. And for whatever reason, he decided that he didn't want to be here this morning. So I had some friends here in the area who know one of the gentlemen I'll be introducing to you in a moment, and he said, hey, you might try him. And he actually knew another guy, and so that's kind of how this is going. There's nothing about this is staged. We just met this morning, and I told these guys, I said, I'm not going to throw any questions at you or tell you what the questions are, because I want this to be a real conversation, just like the kinds of conversations you might have at work or in your neighborhood or with other people. So if you haven't got this information yet, we're here to keep it real this morning. All right? And to keep it real, I think, you know, there are two songs that that might fit real nicely to kind of kick us off here. And the first one, for those of you maybe older, you haven't heard it yet, it's just kind of getting out there. Check it out, and I think you'll understand why I think these two songs kind of depict the real reality of where we are in this culture today and why this conference and what we're talking about is so significant. Let's check it out together. Opposing views. If you haven't heard or watched the video that Ozzy Osbourne has put out in his new hit single with his new group, you got to check it out. It's really intriguing, and he looks at his lot of war pictures and a lot of things, and just raising the question: is God really dead? And then, of course, from the Christian side of the street, we have this song, and I'm sure my friends up front here are kind of maybe laughing. I don't know if you guys are laughing at this point, but, you know, God's not dead. He's surely alive. He's roaring on the inside. You know, he's like a lion roaring on the inside. I'm like, I'm not sure that offering that out there in the culture is going to really help anybody solve some of their intellectual problems as much as I like the song. We are told, and this is a verse probably that by the end of this conference you'll all have memorized, in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15 and 16, that we're supposed to be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks us. But we're to do this with gentleness. We're to do this with respect. Can I be honest here, and because I'm all about keeping it real, my concern for this conference is that maybe some of you come here, and this conference for you is an opportunity to kind of load your machine gun belt and go out and just have at it out there at anybody that you feel like does not believe and behave like you do. And I think that would be a huge, huge mistake. You'd be missing the spirit of this passage, which says we're to do this with gentleness and respect. And I assured my two guests today, as we're going to be on stage, this is not going to be a Jerry Springer show. We're not going to have a throwdown here. And so when I open it up for Q&A, I hope that you would observe the spirit of this passage, that we would be doing and asking our questions with gentleness and respect. Why is this so important? And why am I so excited about what Xenos has offered here this summer at this year's Institute? Well, maybe it might be best be captured in a piece that I'd like to read to you. You can actually read along with me if you'd like. This is a young man that I met in a coffee shop down near Cincinnati where I live. And one day I was actually working with my Apple and I forgot my power cord. And I knew I wasn't going to get my work done. The high-speed internet situation. I live out in the country and we don't have high-speed. We live out in the dark ages. And I was trying to get some work done. And so I asked this guy to borrow his cord. And we started talking and just having a really nice conversation in the coffee shop. And somehow we got around the topic of religion. And he kind of just made it very clear that he sees Christianity as a nice Santa Claus story. And so I invited him to be on the stage here today. But he was very clear that he did not like to be in front of a big group of people. But he's an aspiring author, and when he found out I was an author, he said, hey, I would be willing to write something, though, about how I feel. And I thought, wow, if you'd be willing to do that, I'm certainly willing to read it. And what I'd like to do is to read to you what he wrote, because I think it provides a context for what we're doing up here in terms of the Skeptics Challenge. He entitled it this way. I wish I believed in God. You can read along if you like. I'm just going to read it out loud. I wish I believed in God. I really do. I want to. I really, really want to, but I can't. Not yet, anyhow. Why not? Blame it on logic. I consider myself a logical person. In my opinion, everything that religion is based on defies logic. No proof, nothing, just faith, and that's the problem. I have faith, but sometimes it's hard to hold strong to faith when that faith falls in the face of reason. I was the kid who touched the hot pot on the stove right after my mother warned me not to touch it. I had to see it for myself. I had to experience it. But how do you experience God? Church? Well, not quite. I tried church. When I was a child, my parents dragged me and my brother and me to a Presbyterian church that seemed like an hour away. I got up early, climbed into my itchiest wool pants and jacket, grabbed the clip-on tie and headed out the door in one of the only 2 days I had to sleep in. As a kid, for me, the church was mostly arts and crafts and some lessons I already knew in some form. Be nice to people. Help those in need. Don't be selfish. I get it. Of course, we learned about Jesus, the disciples, the story of Genesis, all the usual topics with a childlike spin. All I really wanted to know was if the Ark of the Covenant was real. I just seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, and to me, religious relics were now cool because they held enough power to melt your face off if you looked at them the wrong way. By that was then, at some point, I graduated into what I called the big church, the room where all the parents sat and listened to the minister tell meaningful stories and explain how to be better people. Essentially the same things we were learning in the children's wing, minus the arts and the crafts. Here's the problem with church. And when I say church, I essentially mean all religious institutions. They cater to those who already believe. You walk in, you pick up a hymn book, you drop a few bucks in the offering tin, and then listen to someone preach about how you can apply their teachings to your everyday life. They expect you to have already swallowed the Kool-Aid. But what about those of us who haven't? What about those who are on the fence? For those who aren't ready to be spoon-fed the same stories that everyone else already believes. What about those of us who are looking for for direction on why we should believe. What about people like me who have doubts, who believe that maybe God didn't make the universe and everything in it in 6 days, that a guy didn't pack two of every animal into a boat and drift around until the rains receded, and dare I say, who don't believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God? Give me some proof to at least help me see that there's something to religion. When I say proof, I'm not expecting God to knock on my door on a Wednesday afternoon and say, I hear you've been asking about me, let's chat. When you place most religious stories under the microscope, they fall apart. Tell me about the ones that hold water. There has to be something, right? Some evidence? Talk to me about it. Give me some physical evidence as to why you believe. And if there isn't any evidence of that kind, anything except faith, then what's the point? What I want in a church is an understanding that I've got questions, big questions, that so far religion hasn't been able to answer. Because for me, the answers to those questions are beyond a tidy story about God or Jesus. How did we get here? Why are we here? Where do we go when we die? Why are we so different yet so much alike? Why is there so much evil in the world and in certain people? I'd love to find a church that believes. Those are great questions. And I don't know the answer, but let's work on it together and find some answers in a logical way. No smoke and mirrors, no blind faith, no because the Bible tells us so. I wish I believed in God, I really do. And maybe if religious institutions ever begin giving me a reason to believe instead of a reason to doubt, then maybe I will. If you're living in the same real world I am, then you would know that what I just read is becoming more and more the norm for a lot of people. The two largest demographics that are happening right now in our culture is there's a group of people called the de-churched who once were part of a church and have come to a point of just saying, hey, I don't really find anything about this that is, like he's saying, that is real, that has substance. And they're saying, you know, no thanks, been there and done that. Over 12 million people are part of this movement of people out of the church. And there's another group of people, 20 to 30-year-olds, that are weighing in pretty heavily when it comes to when they're being surveyed about their religious affiliation. They would no longer, even if they grew up in a Christian home, they would check the box none when it comes to religious affiliation. This gives so much context to what's happening here at Xenos, because at the end of the day, lots of people are asking lots of questions, and sadly, many of us as Christians are mentally soft, and we are not able to engage in those conversations and be involved in those conversations in ways that we can offer something that would reflect the spirit of 1 Peter 3:15 to give an answer for the hope that is within us. So what we're doing here today has huge implications. And I'd like to kick off our time by inviting someone to kind of challenge our thinking. Someone that you probably know real well. Let's check him out together.
I certainly honestly believe religion is detrimental to the progress of humanity. You know, it's just selling an invisible product. It's too easy. These questions about what happens when you die, and they so freak people out that they will just make up any story and cling to it. You know, things that they know can't be true. People who are otherwise so rational about everything else, and then they believe that on Sunday they're drinking the blood of a 2,000-year-old God. I can't, that's a dissonance in my head. I have to find out. I just have to find out. I have to try.
Assurance, Jesus is mine. This is my story. This is my song.
Praise Him, my Savior, all the day long.
Can I stand up here?
So, as I was looking in the air, I just jotted down a few questions that came to my mind. Are you ever bothered by many things that are in Christianity that are not in the Bible, like original sin, immaculate conception, the virgin birth is only in two of the Gospels, popes. Are you worried that these things came not from the founders, the people who wrote this book, but from, and this is indisputable, but from men, from human beings?
I don't know what this documentary is supposed to be, but I don't like where you're going. You start disputing my God, and you got a problem. I don't know what you... I'm out of here. You do what you want to do, but I'm out of here.
I'm just asking questions.
Okay, no problem.
Because my big thing is, I don't know. That's what I preach. I preach the gospel of I don't know. I mean, that's what I'm here promoting, doubt.
Right.
That's my product.
Right.
The other guys are selling certainty, not me. I'm on the corner with doubt. So you are an ex-Jew for Jesus.
That is correct.
Now, what made you decide to be a follower of Christ? What brought Christ into your life?
Back in 75, I went to Michigan State University.
2,700.
Yeah, that's pricey.
Boy, I wonder what Madonna without the child runs you.
So getting back to my story, I could ask God to do things in the name of Jesus and they would happen. So I can't even recall all the little miracles he did, but he proved to me that he was real and he was there.
They were so miraculous and you can't remember what they were?
There were so many of them and they were
Give
so little things. One example I can remember was I was at a party. It was a guy who was working with Jews for Jesus. And I asked him, can I get a drink of water? And he says, you know what? Here's a glass. Stick your hand out the window and pray for rain. Well, I didn't like the attitude. I said, okay. And I stuck my hand out the window and it started pouring rain. Pouring so bad that people couldn't leave the party. To me, that's a miracle. Now, you don't have to believe it, but I know
it is,
God.
It is pretty lame.
But you asked.
Because it just, I asked. I'm just saying, that's why I reacted to your answer.
But that's just one of many things. I live a life of miracles.
But, you know, you live your life with the same sort of mundane coincidence that happened to everybody in the world. It's not like, you know, if it rained frogs, I would say you had a point. But it rains, and it stops raining.
Well, when was the last time you asked for rain and it started raining within 10 seconds?
I don't know. I don't ever ask for rain. But if I asked for it really bad and it started to rain, I wouldn't think it was because I asked for it. I would think because it sometimes rains.
God is not that busy where he can't spend time listening to you when you really want to talk to him anytime.
If Santa Claus can hit every house in the world...
Well, I don't believe in Santa Claus.
Of course not. That's ridiculous.
Right.
That's one man flying all around the world and dropping presents out of chimney. That's ridiculous.
Right.
One man hearing everybody murmur to him at the same time. That I get.
Would y'all want me kind of angled like this or straight ahead? Or?
So you've described yourself as an evangelical Christian. You did a campaign ad where you said the most important lessons in life are in this book right here, meaning the Bible. Everyone in politics likes to brag that they're a person of faith. Do you believe in evolution?
You know, I don't know. Clearly, the scientific community is a little divided on some of the specifics of that, and I understand that.
I don't think they are.
No,
I think they pretty much agree.
I don't know how it all happened. I mean, I'm certainly willing to
accept it couldn't possibly have been Adam and Eve 5,000 years ago with a talking snake in a garden, could it?
Well, it could have possibly been that.
Come on.
This is
my problem.
Yeah.
You're a senator. You are one of the very few people who are really running this country. It worries me that people are running my country who believe in a talking snake.
You don't have to pass an IQ test to be in the Senate, though.
There's plenty of people who would say, well, it's just my faith. But that's not good enough for you. You say, no, we can basically reconcile the science with what's in Genesis.
Well, we're an organization that, to put it in a nutshell, is telling people that the Bible's history is true. It's history beginning in Genesis.
Scientists line up overwhelmingly on one side of this issue. It would have to be an enormous conspiracy going on between scientists of all different disciplines in all different countries to have such a consensus. Doesn't move you?
No, not at all, because from a biblical perspective, I understand why the majority would not agree with the truth. Man is a sinner. Man is in rebellion against his creator.
All these scientists are sinners?
Well, God, who is working in ways we don't always understand.
Yeah, I think that's a cop-out.
He is God. Are you God?
No.
Or something, or you want to be like casual, or
all right. How you doing, Bill? God bless you.
Hi.
Seeing you around. Welcome to our world.
I'm seeing you around. Now, is this your tomb? Is this a real rock?
Or, no, it's just all cement. They just kind of, you know, cemented in there, some more visual.
So, when you go out to dinner, do people recognize you?
All the time, yeah. Like, I think you got a little bit of that, too.
Yeah, but they don't think I'm the Lord. Yeah, they don't think I'm the Lord. You must really be.
Why do you think people come here? Because Disneyland's too smutty?
I personally have been to the Holy Land. So this was an awesome experience for me when I walked on property. I was like, wow, this is cool.
All right, well then let me ask you some questions about your business.
Yes.
Well, really, the Jesus business. God is super powerful. He could do anything.
Sure.
Why doesn't he just obliterate the devil and therefore get rid of evil in the world?
He will.
He will? What's he waiting for?
End times.
But why play it out like that? Why make it a game?
The second coming. It's not necessarily a game. A day is like a thousand years in God's eyes. It says in the Bible, if you don't look at it, just like 2 days ago, Christ died. But I know that he is so far and beyond any of our ways that he can work the worst situation for his good.
What was the Holocaust? Why was that good?
You know, God had a plan for that. Maybe it's to cause.
I wonder if you would have thought that if you were one of the people being pushed into an oven.
Well, you know what? It's like trying to explain to an ant how a TV works. That's God's ways are so much higher than ours. Let me ask you a question. Let's say if you take the side that this is all made up.
I do.
What if you're wrong?
What if you're wrong?
We have our mics out roving. We're going to create and facilitate. I'm going to facilitate some dialogue here. I'm just wondering, as you watch this clip, what does it stir up inside you? What are you really feeling right now after watching this piece? We have our mics here. You put your hand up. You got a couple here in the middle. Go ahead.
It really seems like at least Bill in the documentary here, he's not being reasonable. It's more of he's selling the product of doubt. He's not open-minded. He is intentionally seeking to disprove rather than accepting evidence, even if it might have a just cause. And clearly he's going to the places that he could easily make fun of the most, it seems like. I think if he were to sit down with a Dr. Craig, he'd get schooled pretty quick. So that's kind of my thoughts on it.
He's not here to defend himself, but I would say in defense of him, he did sit down with one of our senators. He sat down with Ken Ham down at the Creation Museum. I think in his documentary, it wasn't like he was out looking for straw men to blow away. And the questions they were asking, would you not say they're at least valid? Although I pick up the tone of what you're saying, and I think, kind of this sense of, I don't know that there's really an openness to really have this conversation. Yeah. Anybody else? Some other folks here, grab a microphone.
I was just going to say, I think if you're a person like me who didn't become a Christian until like I was in college, it should make you feel kind of uncomfortable, because, or at least it makes me really wish to be able to have dialogue, because I thought all those things. You know, if you didn't think through some of those things, then you didn't think very hard before you became a Christian. So it just makes you realize you could, if you could slow down, calm down, have a conversation that was civil, it'd be awesome. But it's going fast. They're a little quick, you know, quick points, and they're not really having a conversation.
Yeah. Tell me, just interesting, is anybody boiling right now? I mean, like, you're really fired. This fires you up. Someone there in the back over here. Go ahead. Tell us about that and why.
I think brings out some real frustration in me because the Christians are so ignorant. And that's what came out to me was how pitifully ignorant the Christians are, and they can't make a solid argument.
The guy on Craigslist, in our conversation, here was one of the things that we talked about, and he said, this is what bothers me, Doug. He said, I'm so bothered because I know Christians who are very rational in every area of their life that I respect so many things about them. But when I bring up rational questions about their faith, they get very irrational, and they a lot of times don't want to answer those questions. They skirt the questions. And he goes, I never feel like I'm having a real conversation with a Christian because they don't want to deal with my real questions.
Exactly. They're ignorant.
Yeah. Yes, back here. Go ahead.
Yeah, this makes me incredibly angry and also sad, more importantly, because there are people with legitimate questions that do have legitimate answers. And it's just like, you know, you have films like this. This is what I think Religious, I believe.
Yes.
Where, you know, it just not only is he selling the product of doubt, but he's like making this more mainstream. This is the thing that like this is okay to do, you know, and that's frustrating because like the Western Church has done like a poor job of like educating or not educating, but facilitating like people to understand this passage, yeah. 1 Peter 3, like, we it are, just, yeah, it's really
frustrating. We are told to love God with our minds.
Right.
And if we're not doing that in a way where we can actually be in the real culture we're living in and engage the real questions that people are raising, then why wouldn't people just kind of write this off as just this blind leap into the dark and this crutch that often Christianity is referred to?
Right. Yeah, it's like, yeah, never mind.
Let's go one more back here, and then I'm going to introduce my guests.
Oh, geez, that's really loud. I think that he, like, had really good questions, like, questions that, like, are really reasonable for, like, any person to ask. And, like, just, like, it kind of made me frustrated, like, to see, like, how everybody, like, just kind of, like you've already said, like, kind of, like, avoided the question and just kind of, like, steered it to, like, this other thing, like, oh, no, like, I don't know what to say, and like they just weren't like thinking about like you know the actual question, and like they weren't sticking with it, and I just I don't know, that made me like really upset.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, let me introduce our guests, and they're going to come on stage. And first of all, I'd just like you to stop and think about that. Let's just for a moment, I'd like you to crawl in their shoes. Let's say this was a conference on atheism, and you were the two Christians representing Christianity. I mean, I don't know what these guys are feeling right now, but, you know, in terms of coming to someplace like this. So first of all, I'm hoping you would honor our guest with your respect to be in a situation like this. And if you could picture yourself doing that and what you might be thinking and feeling right now. Our first guest, Scott Ford. Scott is the president of Human Performance Engineering, a management consulting company. He's an organizational psychologist and CPA. Scott's love of philosophy has caused him to study many different perspectives on life. He currently is a member of two Christian fellowship groups. He has been an atheist since he was 12 years old. And when he comes up, we're going to, probably some of you did a head spin there that he's an atheist, but he's involved with two Christian fellowship groups. That probably for a lot of you. My second guest, Dan Nemira, is saved, as he put it, at the age of 14, he eventually connected with the ministries of Calvary Chapel, where he became a home group leader, Sunday school director in 2000, served as a teaching pastor at Calvary Chapel Church Plant here in Columbus. In 2007, Dan began to question his faith, and in 2009, he finally admitted to himself that he no longer believed. Dan now facilitates the Recovering from Religion chapter here in Columbus and also serves on the board for the Humanist Community of Central Ohio. In his spare time, he still enjoys the study and discussion of religion, anthropology, and philosophy, as in the process of writing his first book entitled Discussions of Doubt. Would you please welcome my two guests here?
Okay. Yeah. Got to know that before I scream at everybody.
I'm sitting here. You've listened. They were here this morning to listen to Dr. Craig. We'll talk a little bit about your impressions of that here in a few minutes. But I'm wondering what you, as someone, please turn off your cell phone. Thank you, Dan. I'm wondering what you guys thought of Bill and the whole religious piece and maybe some of the comments you heard here. Go for it.
Bill Maher is entertaining. He wants to be a provocateur, which is great. I think that there's a whole range of atheists from incredibly mild to very militant, and obviously him being a self-appointed spokesperson, he has his style. Other atheists have their style. But he's using ridicule because it's one way to reach people. Like if you heard something crazy, like there's an invisible pink unicorn in your life and it directs your thoughts, you might want to use ridicule. But it should not be the only tool that someone uses. But sometimes when you hear something that's nonsensical, it seems like it's one of those paths. So that was one of my thoughts about Bill Maher.
How about you, Dan? What did you think when you...
I'm Daniel. The Lion's Den, I take it, right?
No, you're the lion in the Daniel's
according
Den.
According to William Lane Craig, now I feel no guilt for going to the Lion's Den. But, frequent it more often. No, I'm just kidding. As Scott pointed out, I mean, you got to understand, he's a comedian. And so, I mean, yes, he is selling a product. He's selling comedy. And he's wanting to sell his DVD. So that's the tool that he's using. But as Scott also pointed out, is that there are different tools, different methods. Just as in Christianity, I mean, I was a Christian for over 20 years. There's different ways you talk to people. There's different forms of evangelism. And so from this side of the fence, you know, there's different ways that you engage people, and that is just one of them.
Okay. Let's talk about this side of the fence. Scott, we'll start with you. You made it clear in our phone conversation that at age 12, I'm not sure what the defining one moment was, but for you, that was a time when you knew you were declaring or driving a stake in the sand that you are now an atheist. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your journey and what was compelling about this philosophical worldview called atheism, and you've hung on to that. And yet, the intriguing thing, I think a lot of people in the audience would want to know, why would you show up at two Christian fellowship groups?
It's a good question. I was raised Catholic. I know some of you will say, okay, he got the wrong brand. If he had only had ours, he would be different today. Possible. I went to CCD classes. I think I was in a kind of a gentle, laid-back kind of Catholicism that my parents had. And I went to CCD classes. And as soon as I heard it, I went, this doesn't make any sense to me. And I don't think I was an avowed atheist at that point, but I certainly had heard enough to just kind of drop it. And then later on, just jumping ahead to Ohio, you have to understand, I'm originally from the Bronx. And the East Coast Christianity looks nothing like Ohio Christianity. And I've been here for 14 years now. And when I walked into a Panera and saw people bent over the gold leaf book holding hands, I thought I had gone to a different planet. And it made me come back and start to think about this and say, I need to have a more explicit reason to not buy into this than just simply walking away from it. But one of the things, and I'm just going to be brief because I know I could, Dan and I both loved this topic, so I'm going to try to be brief, is I wanted to find better reasons to be good than because God said so. I found that to be an unappealing reason. Like, for example, if you have a four-year-old that wants to eat cookies before dinner and you can't explain about nutrition to them, you just say, because I said so, that's why you can't have the cookie. Because they're not going to understand nutrition at 4 years old. Well, I also want to be treated as an adult and not just told, because God says so, kind of in the opposite of William Lane Craig. So I went out and I found better reasons to be good. Hopefully we'll get to some of those later.
Dan, how about you? I got to think this is kind of surreal for you. Here you are, a guy who used to be coming to conferences like this, a church planter here in the city of Columbus, someone who I didn't pen these words, Dan did. He put the word saved at the age of 14. Take us through kind of your kind of exiting stage left, if you would, Christianity, and embracing this journey you've been on here.
Well, it's kind of hard to sum up 20 years briefly, but the if you would have told me 10 years ago that I would be on stage at a Christian conference as an atheist, I would have told you you're crazy. I lived my life, when I used the word saved there on purpose, because, I mean, my life as a Christian was very real to me. It was my identity. Jesus was everything. And my life centered around my love for God, his purpose and plan for my life. I devoted everything that I did for what I felt God wanted me to be doing. And so to sum up, you know, what caused me to be where I'm at is kind of a hard question, because it wasn't overnight. It didn't happen just one night where an atheist came in and witnessed to me and I prayed the atheist prayer and accepted, you know, atheism. Basically, it was a long, hard struggle of doubt and a journey of questions. And, it started around 2007. I was still active in church at that time. After a period of time, I finally got to the point where I didn't feel comfortable leading a home group study at that time. And so I actually went to the pastor I was serving with and said, I can't do this. I don't feel comfortable giving answers that I no longer believe. So after several conversations and breakfast with him, he basically told me it was a phase, that I would get over it, et cetera. But I finally admitted to myself that I no longer believe.
Can I stop you there for a second, Dan? Now, when he said it was a phase in the sense that you were raising the doubts and questions that you had, and that was his response to those, that was his answer, so to speak, kind of nicely, tightly sweep under the rug and hope that some point this is going to go away, or it was just his attempt to explain what you were going through at that time?
It wasn't meant in a condescending manner. I mean, I still, and I'm not going to mention names, because I still very much respect the man, and I've had breakfast with him several times, even now that I'm on this side of the fence. But the point was is that he was trying to convey to me that everybody has doubts, and that essentially pray that God would give me the answer. He did try to answer some of the questions I raised, but after reading multiple volumes and books where I just no longer bought the apologetics, it wasn't an easy answer. So in a way, yes, it is just pushed under the rug.
Okay. Being that you are on stage here today at a Christian conference, what stereotypes do you feel like you encounter a lot when people find out that you're an atheist, that Christians have about atheists, that you guys would like to speak to, diffuse, or just, you said something interesting that you talked about the different range of the militants, the softer atheists. Mm-hmm. That was intriguing me. Just anything that you guys bump into out there that kind of you feel like often you get labeled or stereotyped. Because once you say you are an atheist, you guys pick up on any of that vibe from the Christian community you'd like to speak to?
I would just say this might be, I thought about what are my goals here today, what mild goals I have. And one of them is if everyone here today leaves a Christian or a stronger Christian, I'm okay with that, which sounds a little unusual because I think that you're wrong. I do think that you're wrong, or I wouldn't be sitting on stage up here. But I want to point out that atheism is a very mild thing. It's much more mild than you think it is. Atheism. I'm not saying that all atheists are mild. Atheism is mild, meaning that all it means is that you've been exposed to an argument about the ruler of the universe. You've looked at that argument and you say, nah, insufficient. And you go on with your life. It's just a blip to us. It doesn't mean life or death. It doesn't mean eternal salvation. It doesn't mean whether or not there's an afterlife. It just means that it's like any other argument that might come to you. I don't want you to mischaracterize atheists. The last gentleman that spoke in the William Lane Craig talk, are we depraved, etc. Hedonism, I'll say this one thing. I couldn't speak to William Lane Craig, and he's not here to defend himself. This is just wonderful for me. Either the false dichotomy of either you believe in God or you think that rape is acceptable. I'm not going to go into depth here, but don't mischaracterize us. A baby's smile, a sunset, the touch of the hand of your spouse, all of these things are just as meaningful to me as they are to you, possibly more, because I don't let anything else interfere with it. I can experience it directly. So when you speak to atheists out there, if you meet them, don't make assumptions about that we're lost, angry. We are just living the best lives we can, just like you are. As a very much a post-religious person, I see all of you as trying to figure out what the shoulds are in your life. And you've picked Christianity as the mode to answer your shoulds. I've picked different modes, and I think that they're more effective than the Christian mode of answering what ought I to do with my life. And we can keep going with that, but just it's about mischaracterizing us.
Dan, any stereotypes you feel like, because I'm thinking, man, a defector, if you would, from the Christian tribe, I would imagine there are brothers and sisters who come at you and, you know, there would have been all kinds of intriguing conversations with that.
I have lost a lot of friends on Facebook.
And in real life.
Yeah, and in real life, yes. Stereotypes, I think I will echo somewhat what Scott had said, is that you need to understand atheism is not a belief. Atheism is a statement of non-belief. You are all atheists in regard to Allah. You are all atheists in regard to the Mormon God that lives near the planet Kula. So atheism is a statement of non-belief, and basically, as Scott was saying, is that you know you need to look at your life, and I think every single one of us are looking at our lives and trying to figure out, well, how do we live it? Christianity is an answer, but there are other answers, and as Scott has said, I have found more adequate answers for my life. I am on the board of the Humanist Community of Central Ohio, and I will say that the representation of humanism that William Lane Craig gave is not accurate either. So that argument that an atheist is somebody who's simply in rebellion against God is probably one that I don't really appreciate, because as I said, it was a very hard struggle for me whenever I was leaving faith, if you will, and not to go off on a rabbit trail, but I will share this from my heart. One of the hardest things for me to let go of was Jesus Christ, was the idea of my Savior. Because Jesus was so central in my life, the fact that he had died for my sins, and for me to go through all the intellectual arguments and go through all of the, you know, is the Bible the inerrant word of God? Does science contradict Genesis account? Is evolution true? All of those intellectual theological arguments does not address that very personal question of whether or not Jesus is my Savior and Jesus is the Lord of my life. So that was the hardest thing for me to let go of. was that concept of Jesus. And it was simply, I had to step back and look at it from the claims that Jesus was a man. If Jesus was a man, then the claim should be the claim should add up, but they no longer did. And so that idea that I was in rebellion is probably one that bothers me the most.
You guys both describe yourselves as you're really into philosophy, you're into these kinds of conversations. Help the audience, help us all from your perspective. What is it, the appeal as a philosophy, landing the plane, so to speak, on the atheist tarmac? What do you find most appealing? And I'm going to come back and ask, where do you find yourself still philosophically going, wow, there's some things here that I'm still wrestling with?
Why, again, atheism isn't necessarily a position. Atheism is a statement of non-belief. And so as I came to the place where I felt the claims of Christianity no longer added up, the same as I'm assuming that most of you would say the claims of Mormonism.
But what appeals to you?
I'm getting there. The claims of Mormonism do not add up. So as I began to look at all of that, I had to take a broad picture, a broad brush look at what is religion doing. And basically, every religious culture does have things that are in common. And it is that tie of morality, if you will, again, to piggyback on William Lane Craig. Who was in there? I just want to know who I'm addressing. Most everybody. Okay, good. Again, I'm glad he's not in the room to attack me, but... But anyway, the point is that I disagree with this position on morality, because the idea that you say, well, God is a source of morality, well, the question that it begs is, which God? Is it Allah? Is it the Mormon God that lives on the planet near the planet Kolob? So that to me was one of the questions that I did have to come to. As I said, let go of my faith and my love for Jesus in my life, because I didn't. It's not like you can just replace Christianity and say, well, if you like this, in Christian music, if you like this artist, then you'll like this artist. You guys know what I'm talking about, right? So within the spectrum of understanding, going from worldview, it's not like you can just say, well, I no longer want to adhere to Christianity, so I'm going to choose, quote, atheism. Now, you might be able to do that and say, I'm going to leave Christianity and go to Islam, or I'm going to go to Christianity and go to Jehovah's Witness or Mormonism, but atheism isn't that way. So the humanism, the view that we are all on this planet, we are all on this rock, trying to live life the best we can, that was the thing that really anchored me. So hopefully that tied it all up. Basically, it is the big picture that we are all humans, and humanism is what I do believe. Atheism is what I don't believe.
Okay. I'll tell you one of the problems I have with atheism. And I mean, Dan is technically correct. Dan is technically accurate about what atheism is. It's just a response to something else. We atheists have a joke. Philatelism is stamp collecting. So if you were to say, what do you like to do on the weekend? And I say, oh, I like to not collect stamps on the weekend. What? You like to not collect stamps? Yeah, it's my favorite thing to do. So he's correct in saying it's a non-thing, but I think atheists make the mistake of not having a coherent alternative. Because I'm not really an atheist. I mean, I am, but that's incidental. What am I? So, and as I was mentioning to Doug, I borrow from a lot of isms. I'm an ismist. I borrow things from Christianity, and I'll tell you later what I like about Christianity. I like Taoism, the Eastern philosophy. I like objectivism, the philosophy of rational self-interest. I like existentialism, that says that I'm responsible, that existence precedes essence, that I'm here before I know what I'm doing here. And so it's up to me to define it. But you were saying, where's my passion for atheism, if we can use that word? My passion is, I believe that we live in an indifferent universe. It's completely indifferent to us. And I believe that when I die, I'm just going to die. And I disagree with William Lane Craig that that means that nothing matters. So the humanists would also say this. I have to be the good in an indifferent universe. Passion. Passion to be good in a universe that does not care about you. So if you want to call that being your own God, that's a little bit of a stretch. I'm a fallible human being. I do the best I can. But I can wake up every morning excited to be the good in the world. And by the way, the one nice thing about an indifferent universe is when you move it, it moves. How cool is that? Like, you have power to get things done during the day. Now, when you push on a person, they push back. So that's okay. That's just a different way of influence. You can't influence a rock the same way you'd influence a person. But I love to wake up every morning and have that challenge of being the good in an indifferent universe.
You mentioned, Scott, that you find some things attractive about Christianity. I'm sure everybody, when I introduced you, kind of their head was like, let's do a double take here. You've been an atheist since you were 12, mm-hmm. and yet you're involved with two communities of Christians mm-hmm. that you meet with weekly or regularly in yes. some sense. What is it about that that would cause you to want to, you know, move into a group like that? Tell us about the appeal to you okay. of Christianity.
I'll do that briefly. First, I'll tell you what I like about Christianity. Then I'll tell you why I'm in these groups. There's two ideas in Christianity that I know that I haven't completely puzzled through yet. It might take me another 10 years. It's generosity and forgiveness. Generosity doesn't always seem to be rational. And I find that when I am generous and I model the behavior of some of my Christian friends and I am more generous than the situation calls for, there's a certain something that I feel. You can even use the word spiritual if you like, although I don't believe that there are any souls or anything of that nature. And the other one is forgiveness. When someone clearly does you wrong with bad intentions, in other words, it wasn't an accident, they set out to harm you for whatever reason. There are times when I have found forgiveness to be another thing that you have to experience it to understand it. If you look at it from a purely intellectual standpoint, sometimes forgiveness, you want justice, not forgiveness, justice. Anger and justice. And so I'm going to continue to think about those things. Fortunately, I don't have to buy into the supernatural aspects in order to explore those. And very briefly, my perfect group would be a self-development group of a bunch of men that get together so that I could learn, so that I don't make all the mistakes that they've made and that I'm going to continue to make. So I need the wisdom of these men's fellowship groups, because you can't live in a vacuum, and there's no other way to get a group of men that work and have families to get together on a Friday morning except for this sort of thing. And they know that I'm an atheist, and they accept me as much as they can. They hope for me, but I get enormous benefit from them, and I hope they feel the same about me.
Thank you. I hope as we're talking here on stage, you have some questions, and at some point I'm going to turn to you in the audience, and if you want to write those down, if don't lose one of those questions that might have popped into your head, because at some point I'm going to turn and it's going to go from myself to these two to you and them. So a couple of other questions. You know, at this point in terms of where you're at in your journey, and I'm going to throw this one to Scott, in light of the difference in your stories. What do you think it would take for you to believe? And to someday be at this conference, kind of on the flip of what Dan's done, kind of you're here saying, I never thought when I came on this stage as an atheist that someday I'd be, you know, on the other side. Mm-hmm.
This is a tough question, and it's not one that I've thought through. So, I mean, prior to this particular meeting, so you'll get my raw answer. There's nothing practiced about this. Atheists usually avoid the term worship. I don't worship anything. But if I had to pick something to worship, it would be rationality. And people make the mistake, I think, of thinking that rationality can't include choosing rational values, like valuing a human being over kicking them in the face. That I also think that that's a rational choice. So some people give rationality short shrift, but because I hold rationality in such high esteem, if I either got evidence, or as William Lane Craig would say, if God was truly logically necessary, then my ethics would compel me to entertain the idea and accept it if there was enough evidence. And regardless of what my emotional preference might be, I think that reason is bigger than me. I don't reason perfectly well, but I hold reason as something to revere. So that's what it would take
so,
for me.
So in some sense, the piece I started with my friend in the coffee shop, mm-hmm. you probably resonated with that.
Yes.
He's basically saying, hey, no one's ever shared anything with me that would compel reason-wise, would cause me to say, hey, this is legit. I can't just walk away from this. I can't just dismiss this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which brings us back to the passage of 1 Peter 3:15, doesn't it? And why this conference, and why this conference is so important. And I hope that in a very redemptive way that some of what you're hearing up here is unsettling you. And it's raising questions in your own mind, maybe even doubts. Because, you know, an unexamined life, Socrates once said, is not worth living. And I'd like to submit to you that unexamined faith is not worth holding on to. That a lot of the reasons why I think Christendom finds itself in the state that we have right now in America, some of the stuff that I shared, is that when these kind of real conversations are being held, that a lot of times, as some of you noted in the clip with Bill Maher, that we as Christians haven't done our homework. We haven't shown up in ways that would compel somebody who's looking for some reasonable explanation for faith, that we're not really giving that many times in our conversations. A couple more questions, and I'm going to kick it to you guys. So if you're itching to get one, be prepared to throw your hand up. We'll have the mics roving around here. And this is a question I've been waiting to ask you guys. Will you get into conversations with Christians? And I'm sure you've maybe had some who move towards trying to convert you, or try to feel like you kind of feel like there's this agenda to try and get you to go somewhere. What's annoyed you about those? And maybe what have you found just laughable? Just like, really, seriously? You're gonna say that to me? If you could be that honest.
Actually, I don't find anything laughable. You know, as I said, and I don't know. I want to back up one moment, if I may, because I want to make this clear: is that my presence here, I hope, doesn't anger you in the sense that you are angry at me as an individual, because I don't have anything against anybody individually. When I discuss these things, It is an intellectual or philosophical argument. My wife still believes. I still have friends who are Christians. I have friends who are pastors. So, I mean, when you say, do I, you know, in the confrontations in life, I try to avoid them because I think the again, back to where I'm at, is that we're all on this journey together. And so I want to respect people for where they're at. As I said, my journey of doubt took over 2 years. And if an atheist would have come up to me and laughed at me, and mocked me. I don't know if it would have done any good.
What I meant by laughable is that, like in the clip here, I think we saw some things that were somewhat laughable. I mean, the senator.
They are.
You know, that's kind of what I was referring to.
Sure.
If you've had Christians or things that they've done, and you're on the other end of the conversation, and you just find them to be kind of really extremely annoying.
Well, they are, but I guess it's like everything in life. I mean, you gotta learn when to bite your tongue. I mean, how many of you guys have any friends who are Mormon? Okay, look at those number of hands. Okay, now, how many of you understand the claims of Mormonism? They are absolutely ridiculous. Okay, but yet you don't want to actually belittle that individual for holding those elements of faith. It's very important to them as an individual. So when I have conversations with somebody about the claims of Christianity, that's where I put it. It's a very difficult thing to do, but I try to separate that from the person. So,
okay.
the things that Bill Maher was putting up there were laughable. I do think now, honestly, I look back at it, and then the things that I believed as a Christian are laughable, that there was a literal Adam and Eve, or that, you know, Noah's Ark, you know, existed, or that the world was literally flooded. I mean, those kind of claims are laughable to me, but I try to avoid the appearance of mocking, you know.
Bro, so. I get you there. Yeah, I get that. What about you, Scott?
I have some short answers here. One thing that's depressing is I've been to various churches and been invited to church, and I go and I enjoy myself, and I'm having a conversation with someone, and if I think, oh, it'd be neat to tell them that I'm an atheist, they go from the smile to the, and they, it becomes the only thing that they can talk about, like whether or not that the fact that I play piano or that I like martial arts or that I run a business, it's all gone. Every other point of connection that I could have with them is gone because they must make this sale. And I am now a prospect, not a person. And it's happened over and over again because they need to be comfortable with the idea that people get through their lives in ways other than they do. And not that I mind the conversation, but I'm gone. Scott Ford is gone. And so I will tend to hide the atheism because I'm after connection with other people for all reasons, for business, for personal, for common interests, and it always interferes with that. And the second thing is, I'll just stick with two, is kind of the smug, I'm in touch with the king of the universe and you're not. So in other words, I have some secret sauce that if you listen carefully enough, and my thought in my head, I don't say this out loud, is I have access to all the information that you do, all of it. I have the same Bible. I can go to the same classes, I can listen to the same speakers, and I've drawn a different conclusion. So we're equals. And if you come at them with the, I am divinely inspired and my words are going to be better than my own words as a human being, I find that a little, just kind of sigh.
Okay. So kind of a, maybe a condescending, kind of a talking down to.
A gentle condescension.
Yes,
I mean,
right.
I don't think they set out to do that.
Yeah, I don't think you're right.
You've got a wireless connection to the ruler of the universe, I would be able to feel a little superior too, yeah. in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, I promised you guys a chance to jump in on this, and maybe a lot of things that have been shared up here on stage have stirred something up in you. And let's get our microphones here. We've got quite a few hands up, and the guys know we want to tell you that if this goes long, we'll dismiss you at some point because some of you are maybe, you know, you've had enough cerebral stuff this morning already and go for lunch. That's fine. But we'll hang up here as long as you want to hang in terms of engaging the questions. So don't want you to feel like we're going to just take three and then boom, That's it. We're done. Go ahead.
I just wanted to find out a little bit more about the humanistic side of your belief, because you said atheism is a non-belief, but humanism is a belief. So I just wanted to find out a little bit more about that.
Humanism is pretty simple. We're all humans. And basically, to answer that question of the basis of morality from a humanistic perspective, it is very simple. Two words, empathy and reciprocity. Okay, we all feel empathy towards our fellow human, and reciprocity is looking at, well, what is going to be the end results of each action. And that is the basis of every decision that we make. It's the basis of what we do as a society. I mean, I'm going to open up a can of worms, but the whole argument over same-sex marriage that's big right now and opposed by the religious right, empathy is looking at that individual and say, you know what, I may not be gay, I may not understand why another man is attracted to another man, I may not understand that in my personal life, but empathy says, I want that other individual to have the same rights I do, and so therefore the law is passed.
And reciprocity.
And reciprocity. So that is the basis of how we live as a culture, is basically under humanism. In a pluralistic society, that is what ties us all together. You know, religion comes into play when you walk through the doors of your church, but when you're out in the world, it's humanism that we're all living.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Thanks, guys, for being here and for taking questions. Appreciate your attitudes. My question is directed toward you, Scott. When you mentioned earlier in response to Doug's question, like, what would it take for you to believe in Christ and God is the only true God, that kind of stuff. You kind of mentioned evidence. You said if there was enough evidence. And the way I hear that is, if you had enough of the correct evidence for you, and my question is, what would that be? What would you accept as evidence?
I'll try to keep this brief. I always have so many thoughts running through my head. Think of it when you say extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. For example, we don't know that Socrates actually existed, because he never wrote anything. Everything written about Socrates' philosophy was written by his students. But I don't need to question whether or not Socrates actually existed, because he didn't claim to walk on water or save humanity. He just had some ideas. So the larger the claim, the more I want. And I would imagine everybody in the room does that.
Take a quick time out. How many of you feel like that's fair? Okay, all right. Go ahead, Scott. They all think you're fair and balanced. You could be on the Bill O'Reilly show.
There we go. So I would need something that could not be attributed to a natural cause. Could not be attributed, you know? And you can come up with any number of those. Certainly a 500-foot-tall Jesus walking down the street would be a good start. But if someone also came up to me and said something very, very, very specific that nobody else could know, you know, because we don't want crossing over with John Edward, where you say, I'm sensing someone that's someone with a P. It starts with a P. Well, maybe it's an L, but it's close. Is it a P or an L? Oh, L. You know, where he's fishing for stuff. So that would be another way that I could be convinced, is if someone said something to me that was so personal that it couldn't have any other cause. I don't know if that answers your question.
Right here, next mic, right here.
I heard a lot of your objections. I'm right here. I heard a lot of some of your objections, like the one to William Lane Craig's lecture today about which God it is, things like that. And I've heard a lot of the objections you brought up before talking to atheists. I don't know if you can answer this, but why do you think it is that a lot of people have heard some of the same objections you have, Christians over the years, a lot of theists, and Some of us are able to work through those and stay theists and, you know, hear the same objections over and over to Genesis, reliability of the Bible, things like that. A lot of us work through these objections and stay Christians, and other people don't. So what is it that some people seem to be able to work through them and others can't? Is it psychological, is it emotional, or intellectual, or all three? What do you think?
Cognitive dissonance.
That's it?
Well, I mean, I don't mean that in a condescending way, but I mean, we all suffer from it. I mean, if you guys understand what that word means, it's basically when you are actually holding two different thoughts or beliefs in your head and they don't add up, but yet you will lean to one or the other and you'll cling to the one that makes the most sense to you. So, I mean, I don't mean it in a condescending way. That's my answer to your question, is that, you know, even as when I was a Christian, you know, when confronted with those questions such as evolution, I mean, it's now honestly becoming more and more acceptable within Christianity to accept the undisputable fact, in my opinion, of evolution. But yet there are still people like Ken Ham. Okay, so, you know, where do Christians fall on that? And when you're saying, well, I accept evolution, but how does that reconcile with the Bible? And so you'll end up leaning towards the things that make you more secure in your faith. I mean, that's what apologetics do for the individual, is they answer the questions that you're struggling with and, you know, help you feel more secure in your faith. I'm not trying to be mean in saying this or coming across as the arrogant atheist, but if you were at a Mormon, I keep mentioning this, but I mean, if you were at a Mormon apologetic conference, they would be defending the claims of Mormonism. If you were at an Islamic apologetics conference, they would be defending the claims of Islam. And most of those believers would walk out of there secure in their faith. Well, how? How is that possible? How is it possible that they can still cling to those elements of faith when they've been debunked? Same, I would say the same applies towards the claims of Christianity. As Scott said, the bigger the claim, the more evidence that's required. And, you know, Scott may come across as searching. I'm not. So, you know, that's the difference.
Where our next mic over here?
Good morning. I'm John. Scott, you had mentioned because you don't believe in a deity that the goodness, the moral origins is within you. Mm-hmm. And I have to question in the world system that we live in, how do you reconcile that humans alone have this moral origin within themselves, but no other creature does, and what the consciousness that stems from that, and where that comes from, and the language that we use with greatness. We were talking about morals and greatness with Mr. Craig's. Obviously, good would be better than evil in the terms of greatness, and how you would reconcile that with the evil people in the world that we know that just, obviously, they have no conscience and they commit heinous acts, and how that origins in them versus other people and the randomness in that.
Okay. Thank you, John, for letting me indirectly debate William Lane Craig. Dan and I may differ here, which you may find interesting, because atheism is, we agree wholeheartedly on that aspect, and then there's other things, like we could be different politically, we could have all kinds of differences, that's okay. I won't be able to develop this, because I'm going to stick to 2 minutes. I try to keep 2-minute answers maximum, but I'm going to describe why Dr. Craig is wrong. I believe that there is a sort of objective morality that can be derived from reason. I'm just going to do this in 30 seconds. It's not going to be satisfying to you. It's not going to be satisfying, but you can look it up later. I believe that everything fits with everything else, meaning everything has its properties and these things interact. And so the universe is non-contradictory. It all hangs together because it must. It couldn't not hang together. It would just be in that format if it were some other way. So everything does what it does and it interacts. And concepts are how we understand that reality. So if reality is non-contradictory, good concepts should also be non-contradictory. And if that's the case, moral concepts are a type of concept. That means that moral concepts should also be non-contradictory. So I do believe that there is an objective standard. Now, what's the basis of it? And this is my personal answer. I'm not expecting you to buy into this. But when I use the term rational self-interest, in other words, what is the purpose of ethics? That's the question, actually. I'm trying to keep this brief, but I think it's important. What is the purpose of ethics? In my mind, the purpose of ethics is survival in full context. So not just that blood is going through my heart or that I'm able to earn a living, but everything, my spiritual growth, my flourishing, my happiness. That's why I am ethical. And in order to have my ethics, I have to allow other people to have theirs. So from that foundation, we can build an objective morality. And it's hard, which is why some people want a programmatic answer like Christianity, rather than having to think through these very hard questions. Not everyone's willing to do it, but not everyone needs to have as many shoulds in their life. As a philosopher, it's very important to me. And I hope that starts to answer it. Let me just one more thing while we're, I wanna make sure I address the whole thing. So, let me ask John one question for you. What age should a child be allowed to drink alcohol? 4, 12, 18, 21, or 25? Can I ask you that question?
That's very interesting. I obviously get put on the spot like you did a couple times today. I'm gonna have to say that that's
Let's
gonna
go
be,
European.
Yeah.
No, it's gonna be up to you know what we've learned about nutrition, and then obviously it's gonna be dependent on the culture. And,
so you're a moral relativist then?
Well, like you, I have my beliefs and I won't force them on anybody. I'm willing to share them and discuss them, but I'm not a bully. I'm not going to force them on anybody else.
In this instance though, you're disagreeing with William Lane Craig then, because you're saying it's very hard to say if there's some age that we, because I don't think it's great to let a four-year-old drink alcohol, and I would let a 25-year-old, and there's some criteria in the middle, and I'm not quite sure what it is. So in that sense, I'm a moral relativist, and I just wanted to give that as an example.
Thank you, but I'm also not a double doctorate.
Sam, I will add on, if I may. Sam Harris, The Moral Landscape, is a good book from this perspective on objective morality.
Yes, in the back, we got a mic back there.
First of all, thank you guys so much for coming up and being vulnerable. Got it?
Yeah.
Okay. Again, thanks guys for coming up. Appreciate your vulnerability and laying yourselves out there. My question is for Dan. In the Bible it says, and you said that you had a hard time giving up that Christ relationship, that, you know, thought of Jesus. So in the Bible, God comes in three parts: God the Father, the Son, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit. And in the Bible, it says that when we accept Christ, that he sends the Holy Spirit as a comforter, as a counselor. Did you ever feel like you felt that presence in your life of that third part of God?
It's not mentioned up here, but when it says I was saved at the age of 14, that was in the Assemblies of God. Guys know what the Assemblies of God is. It's a charismatic church that is very much focused on the Holy Spirit. And that is, again, that's why in my walk, my Christian walk, I was very convinced that Jesus was the center. God was the center of my life. I actually went into the military, and I was in the Navy, and while in the Navy, I was served on submarines. They don't put chaplains on submarines, so they actually have a lay minister. I was, if you want to say, blessed with the opportunity to go through chaplain training, and I actually served as the lay chaplain above my on board my command. When we went out to sea, I led the services. So to answer your question, was yes, the Holy Spirit, the Spirit-filled life was very much important to me, because my sub-base chaplain I reported to, the military divides people up by Protestant or Catholic, and Protestantism, the Protestant chaplain that I reported to was actually a Christian Scientist. They classify it as Protestant, ironically. But he did share with me something very interesting. He was sharing with me that the lay chaplains on submarines predominantly come from the more charismatic type churches, whereas chaplains who actually go into the military and serve as officer chaplains are coming from the more traditional liturgical type churches. So that spirit was very much, and again, back to the, you know, the little things that annoy me is the no true Scotsman argument that's thrown at me is that you were never truly a Christian. I was very much a Christian.
I just want to make sure you understand that we have reached that time where if expectation in terms of leaving, and if that's where you're at, go do lunch, be warm, be filled, be blessed, come back at 2:00 and we'll talk about the Jesus test. For those of you who want to continue in the dialogue, we're going to stay here. So maybe...
Thank you, gang. I appreciate you hearing it.
Yeah. Where are we at with microphones? I don't see a microphone. Okay. Over here? Right here? Okay.
Hi, Dan. My question's for you, Daniel. I was wondering, so you mentioned that your wife is still a believer and that obviously you're not. And so I'm wondering, first of all, have you noticed a difference since you stopped being a believer in your relationship? If this isn't too personal for you, I'm sorry if it is. And I'm curious how you still get along, really.
I am very grateful. My wife, I met my wife in church, ironically, but I am grateful that she's not as argumentative as me on these issues. So it's not really something that causes too much division. Now, I'm not going to say or make the claim that she's not uncomfortable with my atheism, but over the past several years, it's become a little easier where it's not as big an issue. Now, I'm to clarify, maybe I'm lucky also in the sense that my wife is Japanese. So her parents are actually Buddhist. So she's already used to, again, to use that word cognitive dissonance, she's already used to holding these two contradicting thoughts in her head of, you know, the fact that her mother and her brother, who she loves, is going to burn in hell because they haven't accepted Jesus. And now I'm in that same camp. So I've actually told my wife that if it's easier for her to deal with my atheism, she can just consider me a Buddhist. So.
Microphone, where are they?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, Dan, or Scott, white shirt. Yeah, Scott. You mentioned you like martial arts. I just want to know what your favorite one was.
I can't believe Anderson Silva just dropped off the face of the earth. Sorry.
Sad
you know, thing. Just you know, clowning around isn't going to do it. 38-year-old man lays down on the canvas in front of a newcomer. Can't survive it. Don't know what I'm going to do with myself.
Do you actually do any of them or anything?
I was a state champion in judo many years and many pounds ago.
But I still appreciate it now from the comfort of a very soft recliner.
I see.
Okay, let's go back here. We got, yeah, well, go ahead, over yeah. here.
Hey, Scott, you mentioned that you've come to realization that now that when you die, you just die.
Yes.
And I guess this could be for both of you guys, but was it tough coming from like Christianity, looking forward to heaven, like now? How, was it tough or was it depressing to come to the outcome now that you're just gonna die? And is that depressing or?
That's a great question. You know how in Japan, how they always show this in the movies, the cherry blossoms fall over a very brief period of time, like 2-3 days. They always show the cherry blossoms all in the air, and it's beautiful. And I think that things that are temporary are more beautiful than things that are permanent. So life is temporary. Therefore, it's more beautiful because there's not an inexhaustible supply. It should bring a tear to your eye in a way that you must make the most of this. So it bothers me when Dr. Craig says, well, if you don't have an afterlife, then what is it worth it? And I'm like, that's exactly the opposite of how I personally feel. I have to make every moment count because there it's not an inexhaustible supply. And by the way, when atheists say that they're not concerned about dying, I don't believe them. I've heard atheists say, oh, I don't, you know, I'm just going to die, it's fine. I'm not okay with dying. I'd like to live 1,000 years, but I can't overcome my rational side because it serves me so well in other aspects of my life that I can't make special exceptions, you know.
Often Christians in the Christian community, when this topic comes up in terms of atheism, one of the reasons why Christians, ironically, would call and maybe even step out and call you arrogant for the position you take is because an atheist in one sense, as a lot of people would say, is would have to be convinced or have all knowledge to know that there could be a God outside the knowledge that they presently have. You know, and someone kind of put it to me this way. It's like if you're walking in, or just take the internet, if I ask you, Scott or Dan, based on, you know, your web searches on the internet, how much knowledge would you say you presently possess in comparison to the worldwide net? Just a hunch there. 5%.
Well, the it's not a matter of how much knowledge I hold. It's a matter of what knowledge that I do hold.
I want to finish just you kind of there's a question here.
Sure.
Yeah. The question is, you know, what percentage would you say you possess compared to the worldwide net, the accumulation of man's, the libraries of the world?
It's in the 0.0 range.
Yeah, I think that's where most people usually land the plane. And I've heard people go as high as 5%. I'm like, whoa, I don't need to hang out with you. And Christians, this is where Christians, in terms of the other side, struggle with, hey, when someone sounds very confident about their atheism, they're stopping and saying, how, if you only possess, you're acknowledging in your humility, you only possess less than 5% of the world's accumulated knowledge, could you rule out the possibility that there is a God outside the 95% that you're saying that you presently don't have? How do you respond to that from the Christian community? Because that often is where, you know, you talked about earlier about the arrogant atheist. And that's for a lot of Christians will push back on that aspect of saying, hey, couldn't there be a God outside the knowledge that you presently have already admitted that you don't have in terms of your worldview?
Well, even Richard Dawkins does not claim that there is no God. And I'm not claiming there is not a God of some sort. The point is...
Can I stop? How many of you find that intriguing? Is that... Okay. I think... clear that up for us, Dan. That's it's an intriguing comment.
The point of again, where I'm, my exit, if you will, from Christianity was when I realized Christianity is but one of many of thousands of religious systems that have existed down throughout history. I mean, there are more gods that have went extinct than you can even imagine. No one here probably knows anybody who believes in Zeus or who believes in Thor, but yet it is part of our culture. It's part of our society. And so when you look at religious claims, I look at them from an anthropological viewpoint of what is it serving. And I don't know if this is necessarily tied to the question, but one of the things I do miss about the church, and actually I do find lacking it on the atheistic side, is the idea of community.
Yes.
It is very hard to find, if you want to say, people to hang out with. The atheist groups are few and far between. And when I actually started my journey, I felt so isolated, so alone. I didn't immediately go find an atheist. I didn't know they existed. I didn't know the groups exist. That's why now I'm part of Recovering from Religion in the humanist community, because we're trying to spread the word that there are communities of non-believers out there. We don't have meetings every Sunday, though. That's the problem. It's easy to pick up a Yellow Page and you can find a church. There's past, I don't know how many churches on my way here this morning. So that concept of the system of belief is that people need that God, whatever that God may be. So kind of tying it back to the question is that, you know, I can't deny that there isn't a God, but what I address is the God that a person that I'm talking to, what is the God that they're claiming? Does that make sense?
Let me just say something quickly before there's a question. If any of you feel like chatting with us after, we enjoy that. We enjoy you. We appreciate you listening. So just so you know, I plan to personally be available if anybody wants to have at me or tell me I'm okay or whatever you want to do is okay.
Your response to this, Scott, do you feel like in your belief system, where you're at in your journey, that you're not kind of like your feet are planted on this idea there can't be a God, that there is an openness in your heart to the fact that there could be a God outside the present experiences you've had and the finite thoughts that you have and the limited knowledge that you have?
I don't mean this to be disrespectful, but it would be probably as difficult as convincing me that astrology is true, meaning that I find there to be an equal amount of evidence for both of those questions. You know, so I'm a Leo, and that means I have these characteristics, and there are certain days that are auspicious for me to take certain actions and other days not. It would be an extremely uphill battle short of something actually coming to me that... I always wondered, why do we have to argue so hard? Why is there this teleological argument? I would hope that God would be a bit more visible than an incredibly contorted 35-paragraph argument, wouldn't you? You know, so.
Okay. Yeah, Mike here, we got the mic. Got to have the mic.
That's right. First of all, thank you so much. I was raised by an atheist. And at 85, my dad still is. None of our conversations have ever been this rational. So I very much appreciate this. This may be directed more to Scott, but have there been people in your life who've been unbelievably generous, who have been amazingly forgiving, and by seeing the authenticity of who they are, they've led you to question? Because I have to be honest, I'm in the Bill Maher video. I don't have the tools that I need to defend my faith appropriately, to answer a lot of your questions. At this age in my life, I'm still embarrassed by that. But have there been people who you've seen, it's just I've caused you to marvel in a way that say, yeah, there is something there that is so astounding to me
that's outside of general human goodness that makes you wonder.
Thank you so much. That first of all, and I can care about you, for example, regardless, you know, like I already do. And I'm gonna, and it ties into the question that you're asking. If there was anything that would make me a Christian, it's a particular person who I admire so much, and he's a deep Christian, and he's my most important mentor in my life, and I'll name him, and he'll hate that. He's a Xenos guy. His name is Tom Heinmiller, and he is an extraordinary human being. If you ever have the opportunity to exchange a few words with him, he is kind and sincere and calm and centered, and I want to be more like him. Sorry, I'm looking all around, but so the thing that sways me the most is Christians who have clearly arrived. And then I see other Christians sometimes that it's clearly splitting them in two, and they look so unhappy with it, so unhappy. And those are the only people I'm tempted to say, I have some other means of getting through life if you want to hear. If they don't want to hear, that's okay. That's what I said about atheism being so mild. If you're getting through and this is getting you through, I'm very happy for you.
If I may tag on to that, actually, I disagree with Scott that atheism is always mild, because sometimes it's not. You mentioned your father, and I don't know your dad, but I mean I have met several atheists now that I'm on this side of the fence who they annoy the crap out of me. I don't like them because they are hateful and they are mean. To their fellow human beings. There are some atheists who simply want to denigrate and tear down anybody who has any feelings of belief, and I'm not there. So,
yeah. Hi, Scott. So I heard. Yeah. Okay. So I heard you talking about experience and meanings and those words. So my question for you is that: do you believe that we human race is different than a rock or plants or animals, in a sense that we have free will and self-awareness? And if so, where do you think that comes from? If we are just simply, you know, materialistically speaking, we're just more, you know, complicated than they are.
Right. Remember I told you I revere rationality. There's a giant debate as to whether or not we have free will. And I am as uncomfortable as everyone in this room to think that I'm not making choices. However, the rational side of me dictates that I must examine this, and if for some reason I conclude that we don't have free will because there's a preponderance of evidence, it doesn't matter that it makes me uncomfortable. As far as my own answer to that, I'm still up in the air, but the book he described, The Moral Landscape, and there's another book by Sam Harris called Free Will, and it's a disturbing book. There are scientific experiments that say that They have neuroscience studies the brain and finds out that we make decisions a few milliseconds, maybe 800 milliseconds before we actually know we've made the decision. So we're actually watching the movie of our lives with a small tape delay. And I mean, that's simply where the neuroscience is at now. Very disturbing. Help me a little bit again. So just, can you say one more piece about your question? Because it's about free will. It's okay, I can hear you. Just what's the piece I'm missing? Okay, yes, I don't think that we're different. I'm having a little fun now, please. Look at a gorilla's hand. It looks like our hand. Look into their eyes, see the intelligence. We happen to be the latest permutation, doesn't make us special at all. And actually, I'm okay with not being the center of the universe. I'm okay with just being a bit of matter, because I get this life, which I didn't ask for, but what a nice thing to have. And so I'm going to use it and exploit it and enjoy it. But I don't really need to know that somehow the universe is clearly not designed with me in mind. I'm sorry I'm arguing a little bit now, but if 99.99% of the universe is incredibly hostile, I just happen to be lucky. And the reason why things tend to self-organize is because of the sun. We can't get rid of the second law of thermodynamics, which says that things degrade over time. If the sun wasn't there, we wouldn't be here. So that's why there's this input of energy. And I'll stop there. But
right here?
First off, Dan, you mentioned about religion. Your recovery from religion chapter is for non-believers. And then you've got a book coming out entitled Discussions of Doubt. My question in regards to the mention of religion and doubt is, in your life, how do you handle and what does faith, hope, and love mean to you in relation to that? And that can also come back to your input on that too as well, Scott, but just a question for you.
Faith, hope, and love. I don't know why, but the first thought that pops into my head, and whether or not it was there milliseconds before or not, I don't know. But the first thought that pops into my head is music, art. I actually do graphics for a living, and a graphic design and marketing, and so, and my daughter now is she's in theater, but she also does fine arts. My son plays music. He's in the Columbus Symphony Youth Orchestra. So, you know, the idea of the arts and the beauty that I find in that is still very much real to me. It's poetry. I mean, that's what I'm thinking of, those faith, hope, and love. I mean, they're words that we ascribe to feelings that we have. Does that make sense? I hope that answers the question.
Go ahead.
All right, so one of my questions is, like, being a former, this is more for you, being a former Christian who's, like, been saved, you know, something that I believe and Christians believe is that once you've accepted Christ, you're, like, you're going to be a part of God's family, and, like, nothing you can do can, like, kick you out of that, or, like, the Holy Spirit's always going to dwell within you, and you're going to go to heaven, even if you've changed your belief to not believing. So is that something that you don't believe, or do you think that even though you were once a Christian and now you're not, that you're still going to go to heaven?
That's a theological question, and no, I don't believe it. I mean, even within Christianity, you will find people who differ on that. Can a person lose their salvation? I know in the Assemblies of God, when I was actually a teenager in high school, I got saved every Sunday. You know, I had to go to the altar and rededicate my life to Christ, you know, because of just, you know, the what if I did something during the week, you know, that might have caused me to lose my salvation, because that's the theological camp that particular denomination holds to. Now, when you go to other theological camps, when you get into Calvinism, they don't hold that. I mean, they hold to an eternal salvation. However, the answer that they would give me is that I was never saved to begin with, because only the elect are saved. So, I mean, it's a lot of word spinning, and it's a lot of theological back and forth. But to use a word that William Lane Craig used at the end of his talk, practical, where does it actually come down in real life? That's what matters to me. So practically, no, I'm not a Christian, and practically, I never really was saved, if that makes sense.
Mike, yeah, right. Okay, yeah, I'm sorry.
I've had this microphone for like a hot
You got
minute.
The power. Stand up and use it.
I think it was Daniel who said at the beginning that there are a lot of different types of atheists, and I tend to dichotomize them into like open and closed, if you will, like people like you who are willing to have a discussion and talk about things and kind of put, you know, you'll respect me and I'll respect you, and then kind of more the Bill Maher type people who, before I've even opened my mouth, they've decided that I'm, you know, wrong and dumb. And so I was kind of wondering if that's fair, and as well as, like, you know, basically, my question is, like, I want atheist friends. How do I choose ones who want to be friends with me?
Huh. That's an intriguing question.
I would just piggyback on what Scott had said earlier, is that you need to focus on things besides your beliefs. You're not just what you believe, I mean, there's a lot more to you as an individual. You know, what are your likes? What are your you know, passions? I mean, that's what really connects us. I mean, even within a church, you're going to have cliques of people because they have different things that interest them. So the belief is secondary, should be.
If you use religion to separate, I thought that wasn't the point of it in the first place. I always like connection.
Well said, Scott. Yes, go ahead.
Hey, first I wanted to just to talk to Dan for just a second and say I grew up Mormon from the time I was 12 till about 21, and I was actually married in the Mormon temple to a previous wife. So I understand, you know, how we talked about earlier, how certain things are laughable. And I, like you, I was also in the military, and I was active in my church and kind of had a falling away from it, if you will. I was teaching just like you were, and eventually I couldn't do it anymore. And ultimately, obviously, I came to a different conclusion as I left the Mormon belief, started studying and researching on my own. I came to a different conclusion because I'm sitting down here and you're sitting up there. And I just thought that was kind of cool that we kind of had a similar story of growing up pretty active and in military and then leaving to find our own conclusion. But my question was to both of you about something Scott said. Scott mentioned something earlier about evidence that a 500-foot Jesus walking down the street would be pretty good evidence. And it made me think about context of time periods. Really, a 500-foot Jesus walking down the street? I think even as a Christian, I could find reasons to doubt that because of the time period we live in. We live in an age of technology, like you guys talked about, neuroscience beyond I can understand. And you know, all the different cell phones and computers and everything that we can do, we go back to the time period of Jesus. And let's just pretend that he did exist and he was who he said he was. The things that he did to the time period, the evidence, if you want to call it that, to the time period was the 500-foot Jesus to those people because they didn't have the computers and the advancement that we have in our Western civilization. That's why I think a lot of the downfall of the church, of the Christian church, is happening in the Western civilization cultures. So I just wanted to ask, how, if at all, do you think the growing age of technology is affecting your belief or disbelief in a God or Christianity in specific or just anything religious at all?
You're familiar. I'm sure everybody in the room knows what the God of the Gaps argument is. You don't want to pick a question that we haven't answered yet and say that's God because we may answer it tomorrow. So it's always dangerous to pick, like, you know, so right now we used to not know where the lightning came from, so we attributed that to God. And then, you know, it's had to retreat. So I think everybody in the room already knows that you don't say, here's something we don't understand, it must be God. I think the frontier now is in neuroscience and in understanding why people search for such a thing. Like, we're pattern detectors. When snow falls off the roof and the dog goes, it doesn't say, what was that? It says, who was that? Because we attribute agency. Because evolutionarily speaking, agency is safer. If you think that's a saber-toothed tiger in the brush, it's better to be wrong and think it's there than to not think it's there when it really is. So it's an evolutionary trait for us to ascribe agency to things. And neuroscience is going to point out more and more about this. And that's, for me, is the fundamental core of religion. Then, almost like, if you've heard of memes, Richard Dawkins talks about them, that an idea goes through the same evolutionary process that living creatures do. So bad ideas get discarded, good ideas keep changing, And Christianity is one of those memes. It has changed to survive. What I need to make one quick point. The morality of the Bible is static, and yet, and Dr. Craig actually mentioned this, that our morality is also evolving. Like, we think that slavery is wrong now. We think that women should have the right to vote, et cetera, all of which I'm in favor of. But it's becoming harder and harder for apologists to square this Middle Eastern ancient morality with what's happening today. I think that the challenge for pastors gets worse and worse over time. As I said to a friend of mine, there are whole sections of the New Testament that you have to put crime scene tape over and never mention in a sermon, or you'll be trouble. And I think that's going to continue as we, like 100 years from now, we might say, I would never eat an animal. That's cruel. We have this organic vegetable protein stuff that we pull out of a vet. I would never kill an animal. I mean, we don't feel that way now, but, you know, morality continues to move forward.
Yes, right back there.
By the way, thank you for, if you're skipping your lunch to answer our questions. I was told
pizza's coming.
But I've been really excited to be here and just hear your side of view. Just don't get that chance as much being a Christian. But you mentioned the 50 feet tall Jesus thing, and you know, there's all these narratives in the Bible and stories from people where there are these supernatural things happening. And I just finished reading the book of Exodus where the Israelites experience these crazy things. There's food coming out of the sky and like the ocean is splitting and before their eyes. And yet, you know, years later, they're worshiping this gold that they melted from their own jewelry. So I guess, like, if you were the Israelite, would you respond differently? And what was the last part of that? And is it reasonable to ask God to do that if he has the foreknowledge that you won't believe in the end?
I find it interesting that you actually bring up the things in the Old Testament because they're not really focused on too much in the modern-day Christian system of faith. I mean, you have stories like Elijah, who is challenging the prophets of Baal, and he basically is challenging to prove, similar to this situation here, is there a God? Is the God of Israel the true God? And Elijah takes up that challenge and, you know, puts the altar up, has the prophets of Baal make their dance to their gods, and then even pours water on his own offering, if you guys know the story, and God provides. So you have those things in the Old Testament, but yet now, as Scott pointed out, it is almost ludicrous and silly to say, okay, is there a 50-foot Jesus walking down the road? And that is one of the things that actually finally started to sink into my head, was that the claims of Christianity, which are tied very directly to Judaism and the Old Testament, and you have to answer both. I mean, in the early church, there were different sects of Christianity who tried to do away with the Old Testament because they realized some of the stuff didn't add up to what, you know, Jesus was teaching. The Marcionites were basically, you know, saying, you know, we don't want to accept the God of the Old Testament because he doesn't match the image of God that we are getting through Jesus. And so, I mean, that is the challenge of Christianity, and it's the challenge of from a theological perspective that you have to answer. It's not my question, though. So, I mean, it's kind of funny that you bring it up. So I'm not sure if I answered your question or if I just kind of added more to it.
Kind of. I guess I was asking if you had a personal experience like that. Or, I mean, there are instances. I have two friends recently that are having dreams pretty continuously about Jesus, and you would say, well, it could be about a pink unicorn just as easily, but I guess if you were to put yourself in those shoes, do you have without reasonable doubt that you might change your mind and say, wait, did that actually happen?
When I was a Christian and I was in Idaho Falls. It was part of my training. I was being trained. I was a nuclear machinist mate. They put the reactor up in Idaho in case it blows up. It just makes bigger potatoes. So, you know, I was stationed up there. And when I was stationed there, my aunt died. And I was going through a very personal struggle, you know, because I couldn't take leave because I was in the middle of my training. And I was praying to God, you know, trying to figure out, you know, exactly, you know, why this happened, you know, why I can't go home, all this stuff. It was very troubled. And at the time, I was in the Assemblies of God, which to answer or to tag on to an answer I gave earlier, the Holy Spirit was very much active in my life. And so I was praying, and the image of like a road sign, 860, popped into my head. The number 860. I'm like, what in the world does that mean? God, what are you trying to say? And so I literally went through the Bible, book by book, chapter by chapter, and there's only one verse in the entire Bible that has a chapter 8, verse 60. And basically it ties with the idea of when they were rededicating the temple, that basically the God was proving himself. So I attributed that at that time as God speaking to me. So, I mean, I know what you're saying is that as a Christian, there are times when you have those moments. Not to, actually, I will. There's actually a guy, the church that I was part of, he tattooed 860 on his arm because of the story that I gave in one of the lessons I was teaching. So there's a guy, a Christian out there with 860 on his arm because of that story. So it's ironic that now I no longer hold it. But that was one of the things I had to deal with and address. How do you answer that? You know, how do you answer that God, did God speak to me? Well, hopefully this answers the question. What about Muslims who have the same experience, same type of experience? What about Hindus who have the same type of experience? What about Mormons who have the same type of experience? Is God really speaking to each of them individually, or is it something in our brains on the neuroscience level that basically I didn't see 860? I mean, just happenstance. I literally, it took me several hours to go through and dig through the Bible, but it just happened to be a verse. Well, what if I was a Muslim and I dug through and I found, you know, a surah that basically tied to that? Does that prove that Allah is real? Does that make sense? So I couldn't cling to that experiential thing for me. Now, there are people who do, and I don't fault them for doing so. That's the point that I'm trying to make, is that, you know, we are all individuals, and we can discuss the things respectfully to each other, but we have to agree to disagree on certain things. Hopefully that went
too long. Where are we at microphone-wise? We got one here. Get her a microphone over there. Go ahead.
Okay, this question goes out to Scott. I believe that you said something about you don't believe in a soul and probably you're a materialist. And I was just wondering, so you guys probably experience thoughts, feelings, emotions, consciousness, desires, and things like that. And I was just wondering, how would you explain spontaneous generation, which is like the best explanation for the origin of life, and which is a material process, like spontaneous generation, and then evolution, which is the mutation of genes, which that is a material process. So how do you explain a material origin, a material process, but the end isn't immaterial things like thoughts, emotions, feelings, desires, things like that?
Okay.
Scott, before you do, let me, her question, piggyback off of that, because I think this is one that she, if you would read, we could read this together. A lot of Christians would hold that the atheism, in its essence, is a belief. If there was nothing and nothing happened to nothing and then nothing magically exploded for no reason, creating everything, and then a bunch of everything magically rearranged itself for no reason whatsoever into self-replicating bits, which then turned into dinosaurs.
I love it.
You know, her question, sure, you know, kind of pokes into this. This is a kind of one of those you know, it's kind of out there in the Christian world.
Can you feel like I'm in the gate? Like,
you know, so you go for it. I just kind of
sure.
No, you kind of put a little more to it. So
yeah, there's a YouTube video you can watch called "A Universe from Nothing" by Lawrence Krauss, and it is not anti-Christian. It is a lecture about physics. And I strongly recommend it. Lawrence Krauss is an amazing speaker. In any case, let me, I have to try to beat Craig's Callum cosmological argument, which is that everything has a beginning. It turns out that when you weigh hard vacuum, like there's no light in it, there's no material, there's no something, hard vacuum weighs something. So there is no nothing necessarily. Everything is a field. And on the quantum level, what they've discovered is that things pop in and out of existence. I mean, when you take everything out of it, it still weighs something. That struck me as amazing. So we have nothing, or as Victor Stenger would put it, nothing is unstable. Nothing, nature abhors a vacuum. So if you grant me the fact that I don't know how the universe began, but that beginning may not even be a word, that's a word that's useful for us. Like if all the molecules in your body stopped moving right now, just stopped moving, you wouldn't be aging anymore, so time wouldn't make any sense. Time doesn't exist separate from space, so they seem to have co-created at the same time. So then, I'm going to keep this short. The whole universe in 60 seconds, I promise, I'm going to stop there. So there isn't any water or carbon in stars. So how did we get from that to Earth? Supernovae are the thing that created the entire periodic table. That stuff swirls around. It includes carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, all the things that we need for the building blocks of life. Then there's something called chemical evolution, things that are not alive and yet are reproducing. Like, for example, a virus only has 3 or 4 out of the 7 characteristics of something that's alive. And there are things simpler than viruses that reproduce themselves, like amino acids. And then as soon as you have your first organism, evolution can begin. So that term is called abiogenesis, is how you get non-life, you get life from non-life. And chemical evolution would be the process by which that happened. Once you have life, then evolution takes over. And things adapt to their environments, and there's been kind of a nuclear arms race. Lions get faster because gazelles got faster, et cetera. You know, the things that can't survive in the environment fade out. So it's not a random process. So, you know, for that quote up there, there's nothing random. Well, there's an element of randomness in evolution, but it is not random. There is something called selection pressure. You know, that, you know, when if the trees get darker and there are white moths, they're going to be eaten more often. Nobody needs to control that. It's just, it's the cause and effect of things. So I hope that I wanted to give you that. So where the periodic table came from, things mix together, things begin to replicate. The first thing becomes life, and then you get dinosaurs, according to them.
Yeah, over here.
Right here.
We have a mic over here. We only have one left? Okay. Yeah. You got the mic.
I wanted to ask this question to Scott about morality. It was I'm reading this off of an article. It says, in an interview in 1994, Jeffrey Dahmer, the famous murderer, himself explained his thinking. He wondered that if there was no God and we all came from the slime, then what's the point of trying to modify your behavior to keep it in with acceptable ranges? Essentially saying, if there is no God, you have no accountability to anyone else at all. You are your own self, and you can do with yourself whatever you please.
If evolution is true, which I think it is, evolution is not a directed process. There is nothing conscious about evolution. Evolution doesn't have a plan for us to become something else. Although we will continue to become something else, there'll be people or something here a million years ago that will look nothing like us, talking about, you know, what we seem to be like. So we're not we're not any sort of end product. Because evolution is random to some degree and it has no plan, you will occasionally pop out a Jeffrey Dahmer that, because of their brain chemistry, is not going to fit. And while it may not happen with any one sociopath, sociopaths tend not to have happy home lives and raise children, so they tend to self-correct the things, and because of selection pressure, Jeffrey Dahmer's not going to have, you know, necessarily going to have grandchildren. As far as people making choices that are bad choices, certainly that can happen. And that's why atheism by itself is never enough of an answer. I would not suggest that just being an atheist is enough to live a good life. You need to be taught rationality and, Dan was saying, reciprocity. And to understand, like the Bill of Rights, for example. If we don't teach people what the Bill of Rights are and why they're important, the chances of more Jeffrey Dahmers are higher. So you can't, I would not just remove religion without replacing it with something else.
And I would say Jeffrey Dahmer is not really a model to look at.
Okay, over here, she's had her hand up for quite some time. I don't know where all the rest of our mics went. Oh, okay, there we go. Yeah, if you pass that around. It would be really cool if you got a question, come up front, because it's hard to see. You know, there aren't many people sometimes.
Again, like everybody else has, I thank you so much for being here today, and it's been very interesting for me. Honestly, when I was younger, I grew up in the church, and I decided I was atheist because it was a heck of a lot easier to be atheist than worry about someone watching my every move when I got a little older. And then eventually I came back around to God as an adult, but I don't know if you've seen or know of Penn Jillette of Penn and Teller, an atheist, and I've seen several. I used to work with a gentleman that was an atheist, and we had great conversations because he knew the Bible too, so I really respected that. But he has a blog, a video blog, and he talks about evangelism on that blog. And it's a pretty touching thing that he says. My question is, Dan, as a former life in the Christian community, I'm guessing, and with a home group, you did evangelize. And then for both of you, how do you feel when people respectfully evangelize to you now? How do you respond to that?
Believe it or not, I mean, I don't think it's an encounter that is as common as perhaps it should be within, you know, society. I mean, if Christianity is the most predominant religion and believes it has the answer, you know, for eternal life, then Christians should be witnessing to their non-saved friends, or at least trying to find out, you know, who is non-saved. But when I was, I run my own business now, so I'm a little bit different, but in the corporate world, you're surrounded by coworkers, and it doesn't come up as, I mean, you might be able to figure out who is the radical Christians, but I mean, I can tell you, I mean, it was a lot of times whenever I would, even as a believer, I would find out, you know, after knowing somebody for a while and say, oh, you're a believer, you go to church. And then it would begin a conversation. Because, again, tying back to something we'd asked or talked about earlier, is that there are other things in our lives that connect us. Your job, your passions, your likes. So from an evangelistic viewpoint, I mean, that is a style of evangelism that I actually lived out as well, is to get to know people, connect with them on those levels of interest, and then once you become friends, then you can actually have those conversations. So in my life now, I still have Christian friends, but they don't try to evangelize me as much because they know it just turns into not really evangelism, but more of a debate. So
I want to add in one thing, just as far as evangelism goes. I think some people have a script that they're following in evangelism. And as soon as I deviate from that script, I get kind of a, wait a minute, this is my conversation to sell you. What are you, I'm trying to sell you this vacuum cleaner. What are you doing showing me that microwave? You know, and I know it, and it takes them, it really shocks them when I explain my alternative. So I think that good evangelists need to be, are they ready to hear my argument? I think that it really disturbs, when I'm one-on-one, I'll be quite honest, it disturbs them deeply when I start to give my argument. I see a little, and that's when you know that someone has an emotional attachment to an argument. You know, we're not really, it's like, it's okay. They're only pretending to be in a dialogue with me. It's a pretend dialogue, because it's a monologue. They're going to tell me what it is. This is how it goes. Oh, no, don't, no, 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 stop. Okay, you know, so I'm not always a fan of that, and I hope that's useful to people that have those conversations.
Okay, Pam, go ahead.
But to tag on to what you were sharing, I do think Christians can be very poor listeners, and that is something I know I am working on, and this dialogue has really helped me with that, so thank you. Secondly, your pizza has been ordered, so if your stomachs are growling, I promise after I ask my question, I will go check on your pizza and I'll bring it to you. Thirdly, Scott, you had mentioned that you have a friend who happens to be in Xenos. And I forgive me if I misquote you, correct me, but I believe the question had to do with what would be convincing to you. And you brought up your friend and you mentioned some qualities about him. If I could ask you to elaborate some more, I think the words that you used were to see a Christian who has arrived. What would that look like? Because like the person earlier, one of the first questions, the woman who said, you know, I don't have a scientific mind. I am not wired in that way. I know how my life has changed, and I can share that, and I know some things having studied the Bible for many years. But as a follower of Christ, I'm interested in what would that look like for you as an atheist to see a Christian who has arrived?
I've seen happy Christians and miserable Christians. I've seen happy atheists and miserable atheists. And so sometimes what I think is that there are qualities that have nothing to do with the supernatural that are qualities that I want to emulate. And if my friend or my mentor, Tom, happens to be a Christian, I don't always associate it with that. But if you remember early on when I said generosity and forgiveness are, to some degree, seemingly, and I'm talking right on the edge of what my philosophy is now. I don't have answers here, but they can be irrational at times and still valuable. And it may take me another decade to think about why you should be generous when maybe you shouldn't, why you should forgive sometimes when maybe you shouldn't. And that's a very complicated thing, but I want to describe, this is just a person that I would admire, never mind a Christian that I would admire. So I can't say that it's just that, because I also have atheists that I admire greatly. But I still enjoy the stage, as you might guess, because I'm up here. My mentor does not require the stage. He can listen. I have to mention this, I wish the whole room was still here. For Doug to yield the floor to us the way he has and to give us free rein to do what we have done, and I'm not just blowing smoke, is incredibly extraordinary. I didn't know what I expected, but maybe something at the end where, okay, now I'm going to tell you the real scoop, that the empathy with which he has allowed us to just give us free rein, I would like to be more like Doug Pollack in that regard. And yeah, sure. And So I want to learn how to not have to be the center of things, because I have so many opinions and I want to share them, which is why I'm up here. And when I meet people that have that level of love and empathy in them, that their egos, in a sense, are no longer involved, that I find that extraordinary, and I want more of that.
I would add, it's kind of like the quote from Gandhi, which says, you know, I like your Jesus, I don't like your Christians.
Yes, go ahead.
Both of you are businessmen, and so you have customers. And you probably have experienced that some customers are dissatisfied with what you provide, some are satisfied, and some go to the point of being delighted. So you, as consumers of services, also have been in a position of being dissatisfied, satisfied, and delighted. Now, the question that goes to this word delight, and we did a marketing study, and we discovered that people who were delighted were those people who described their doctor, for example, as somebody who listened and understood and cared. Now, you're describing Tom, who listens, understood, and cared. Now, what we concluded from that study was that people who are delighted are people who perceive that they have received sacrificial service. And I'm just wondering, you as businessmen, how you view that, because you don't wow all your customers, but you wow some of them. What have you learned from that?
I have been changing because of Tom's counsel as to how I viewed that. I think the answer I'd give you several years ago is not the answer that I would give you today. If you worry about closing the business, you won't get the business. If you worry about carrying the person, the business will come. That is much easier to say than it is to do, because there's a paycheck. I'm a management consultant. I only get paid for my time. So if I give away my time, then I don't get paid. You know, I'm not on a salary. So. And I appreciate, I'm sure you may have an interesting business background. I'd be happy to hear more about it later. But the challenge of loving someone that you don't know, which is a Christian idea, it's not exclusively Christian, but they are certainly big proponents of it today. I won't say that they invented all the good feelings, but they're certainly promoting them, is a challenge that I'm getting from Tom that I'm going to continue to try to grow, because it's my fear that holds me back from looking into that person's eyes and serving them, whether or not it ends up being consulting. So I appreciate your comment.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead, then we'll go to the...
I have a few thoughts. First, I like your outfit. Brown and green looks great. But also, it reminds me of a tree. Anyways, in room 210 at 345, there's a breakout session called Deuteronomy, Seeing God's Heart in the Old Testament. And I know you mentioned something about law and God's, and the struggle that apologists would have with changing morality. I'm going to that. If you wanted to go with me, that'd be sweet, because that's something that I think about a lot, and I have a lot of questions. And Deuteronomy is a really intimidating book to me.
Who's doing that one?
Kathy Trans.
He wants to go hear Dr. Lennox.
Okay. You go listen to Dr. Lennox. But... I'm going to go to that, and so I think there are answers for that side. But my point originally was, you had said something about how Craig made, or a man asked a question at the end of Craig's teaching, and said that, or asked if our atheists are depraved, and Craig kind of gave the answer, yes. Yeah, which is kind of offensive, but the truth, like the biblical truth, I just wanted to like sort of back up Craig's point. There's a passage in the Bible, Romans 3:23 through 24. It says, "For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and all are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus." So it's not that just you are depraved, but that the biblical idea is that every single human on this earth is depraved, and that the only way we can get to God is through God's gift to us through his son, Jesus. So I just wanted to make sure that was clear, that it's not like that talking down kind of condescending thing. It's actually what levels us and levels the playing field so that we can come into a relationship with God. I want that to be clear.
I just have to say that I don't believe in original sin. I have terrible pride and arrogance. I am the latest, greatest example of evolution on the planet. It's imagined like a monkey slowly standing up like the thing and finally looking up and looking around and saying, I think I understand a few things. So I don't have to struggle with that idea of original sin that you have. I'm not a sinful person. A sin is just an offense towards God. I can do the wrong stuff. I also believe in the words good and evil. I just don't need a supernatural explanation for them. But this idea of original sin, in order to sell somebody something, you first have to convince them that they need it. And so if you're not depraved and in need of God, then the church wouldn't exist. So I don't begin with the idea that I'm fallible and human, but that doesn't mean I'm sinful. And I find that to be one of the worst aspects of Christianity, that we have to start off by saying we're complete scum, but there's an answer. I feel that way about myself. I don't know, Dan, if you have anything to add about...
While we're on that, just for a moment, what you alluded to, hey, it's one of the worst aspects of Christianity. Speak to that. You know, what do you find repulsive about the Christian worldview?
Well, I mean, it does answer that, I think, ties in. I mean, essentially, you've created the disease in order that you can sell the cure. You can't have the good news, the gospel, without the bad news. I mean, you can't go up to somebody and say, I want to share the gospel with you without telling them they're going to burn in hell. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, I understand what you're trying to do in saying it's not meant to be condescending because you're putting yourself on the same level. But the thing is you've taken the pill. So you're trying to sell the pill to me. You see what I'm saying? So that is kind of offensive to somebody on the outside because, as I think Scott had used it or I've heard it from other atheists, is when you look at somebody who is a non-believer as them needing to be fixed, them needing to be corrected, you can't avoid the fact that that is condescending. I mean, it is what it is. You see what I'm saying? Now, I will actually add in a bit of humility from my perspective that we have the same struggle, Scott and I, with talking with people of faith because I don't buy it. So, well, what does that mean? That means I consider that belief as delusional. People who follow Islam, it's delusional. People who follow any of the systems, it's delusional. So I have that same struggle. We're both on the same page there, is that we have to, you know, how do you overcome that quality of arrogance? How do you overcome that quality of condescending to another individual? And that's where it is difficult in this conversations like this because you have to set those things aside. And in my opinion, that's where we... Humanism is, for me, where I find that ground is because I recognize people as being human, as being equal with me on that level, and everything else we can discuss and agree to disagree. Does that make sense?
I just want to add one thing to this idea that to start off with the you're not okay, but we can make you okay. There's just one other main problem I have with Christianity to tack on what you were saying is that how do I explain this? Christians need to split themselves in two. What a painful process it seems to be for you. In terms of, you have to decide in some cases between the moral, as Christianity defines it, and the practical. Meaning that morality, it seems to me, in Christianity, is kind of an unconscionable burden. They're the things that we have to do, whether it seems to serve our purposes or not. So you have to make this choice between the moral, either I do what will actually serve my interests, or I do what the Bible says that doesn't feel good. It's like when the times when you go to church when you didn't want to and you're just waiting for it to be over, and you feel guilt about that. So one of the things I've done is to make the moral and the practical closer together in my philosophy. So the moral for me is rational self-interest, which includes having a great deal of empathy for people around me because it makes me happy. And I want to add something I mentioned between, Dan said empathy and reciprocity. I want to add another thing that makes me moral. Like, why don't I take candy from babies? Why is it when no one is watching me that I'll still try to do the right thing? And I would add in the word pride. I'm Scott Ford, and I'm not the kind of guy that needs to take candy from babies. I can go make money and get my own candy. And that egoistic satisfaction I get from that keeps me from taking money, you know, if I find a wallet on a table. I'm not the kind of guy that needs to take somebody else's cash to get through this world. Ego. Ego is the engine of moral behavior for me. It's not the only one, but it's a powerful engine for moral behavior. You'll find people that do the bad things generally have terrible self-esteem. And the Bible specifically says that humility and sacrifice is inherently good, and I tend to disagree with that. So that's a whole can of worms there, but something to think about.
Okay, over here.
So my question is, both of you are humanists, right?
Like, I wouldn't call myself a humanist.
Dan, would you call yourself a humanist?
Yes.
Okay, I believe earlier you quoted saying, correct me if I'm wrong, that we're all just humans trying to live out life the best that we can. Right. And then I think you said earlier, kind of talking about living a good life. What defines that best part? Like, how do you know you're walking out the best life you can?
I think it varies. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the question you're asking is, what is the purpose? What is the meaning in my life, right? I mean, what defines best rather than just existing?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it varies for every individual. I mean, the things that drive you are different than the things that drive me. They're different than the things that drive this gentleman. They're different than the things that drive her. So you, even though you may share a theological belief with somebody, doesn't mean you're going to have the same drives in life. The difference is that you just answer that as like, well, God's call on your life is different than God's call on this other individual. But that's just words. So from the humanistic perspective, you are everything that is driving you. Your dreams, your goals, you create the meaning in your life. Does that make sense?
So I create the meaning in my life. So what? How do I even understand what meaning is? Would I go to rationale and reason?
I mean, if you want to be a hermit, you know, and live in a basement playing video games, you know, so be it. I mean, there are people that do that, right? I mean, I would look at that and say, that's not what I want to do with my life. I mean, so there are, I mean, it's a very open-ended question to say, well, what is the best life? What is the reason? I mean, everybody's going to have their own drive.
Okay. What determines a best action or a good action or a good life versus a bad life or a worse life?
Is your question kind of like when you pull out the tape measure to qualify or quantify, you know, what tape measure, what are you appealing to determine whether...
Yeah, as she said over there, like, what's the reference point? Like, how do you know, like, how do I stack up? Like, how do I know my life is the best?
The hardest thing about life is that how ambiguous it is, and you guys have solved that by picking a system and going all in with it. Some of us don't pick systems. Some of us borrow from several systems, like I do, and some of us come up with our own, but ambiguity is the scariest thing in life. Who do I marry? What kind of job should I get? How do I live the best life? And some people are incredibly uncomfortable with the fact that there are not clear answers to that. I'm okay with that ambiguity. I use the tools that I have. I love my career. I love my career. I love doing what I do. I solve problems at big companies, you know, with compensation or training or project management or business process reengineering. I wouldn't want to do anything else. I got a little lucky. I have people in my life that I love, and I'm so glad that I met them. But some of it I won't ever have control over, so I won't know if I've lived the best life. And I think I guess I'm okay with that, because I have to be okay with that. I don't have any choice but to be okay with the fact that I'm doing, that I'm satisficing.
And I would add, I mean, you didn't say it, and I'm not meaning this to be attacking, but I mean to imply or to assert that, well, God is the foundation, you know, it is just as ambiguous, because there are so many, even within Christianity, you can't even say Jesus is the answer, because there are multitudes of different types of churches. I mean, how many churches I, again, drove by to get here today, and that expression of faith is going to be different for the individual. Some people like the charismatic churches. Some people want to, you know, come and roll around in the aisles and talk in tongues, et cetera, et cetera. Some people prefer to be Catholic. But yet you still have that common tie that you, quote, believe in God. You still find God as the source of your foundation or purpose in life. But your expression of that is different. So it's no different. That is the same thing as what I'm saying, is that every individual and their expression of how they live their life is ambiguous. You make your own choices. People, if they don't like the church they go to, it is so easy in our society and culture just to stop coming and go visit another church. Church hopping is all over. I mean, you just go find one that you're happy with. I mean, so even Christians are choosing what makes them happy. Does that make sense?
Back there. Can we pass the mic? There you go. Thank you.
Thanks for staying again. One of the things I found in my group, a lot of people that are my friends that grew up with your worldview, outside of experiential things, found predictive prophecy a convincing evidence. And I'm actually reading one of Dennis's books called Satan and His Kingdom, where he deals with some of the difficult things surrounding prophecy, that they are often ambiguous, there's just some difficulties, especially with prophecies specifically to Jesus versus his second coming. Are you familiar with these things that I'm talking about, and what's your opinion? For example, that the suffering servant prophecies come in the context of Israel getting, God discussing Israel, but that there are these specific things regarding Christ, like getting pierced in the hands and feet, Daniel 9, that prophecy about his specific coming. I guess, what's your opinion on those things?
You'll get two different answers there, because Dan will be far more familiar with the Bible, but I'll put it to you this way. The writers of the New Testament read the Old Testament, so it would be convenient to make sure that the writing that you do fits with and builds on the writings of the Old Testament. I would be very impressed if there was something in the New Testament that described the iPhone, you know, or something like that. That would go further for me than, and I think they even said that there may have been some alterations. Maybe Daniel can say more about this, that, you know, about Jesus coming into town on a donkey, and that maybe there was a change to make sure it fit with the Old Testament, because the New Testament writers, they could not throw away the Old Testament, as barbaric as pieces of it were. They had to work within that framework, and it was a real challenge, and I'm not sure that they entirely succeeded. But so this idea about prophecy is, did they get to read it first? You know, we don't have any kind of double-blind experiment here. So I don't know if you have anything to add there.
Not that I'm an expert on it by any stretch of the means, so I will actually refer you to a book. Bart Ehrman, read his books on the Bible and understanding how we got the Bible. The one point that I will make about that is that you need to understand that the Bible isn't one book written by one author. It is a collection of 66 different books written by many different authors, and often contradicting each other. as he mentioned, you know, and even in the New Testament and the you know, quote prophecies of Jesus, they made things fit. Each of the gospel writers wrote to a different audience and was appealing to different aspects of what they were trying to say. So, I mean, we can go into a huge debate on that, but I mean, the Bible itself was one of the turning points for me. Even though I taught it, even though I taught the Bible and taught, you know, Christian life lessons, if you will, from the text, I never actually stepped outside of it and analyzed it and looked at it from a historical perspective. And I think if you do that, you will start to see some of the holes.
Yes, right here, over here.
I was actually going to ask about predictive prophecy, but since you already asked, I'm going to ask a new one. Because you brought up that authors tried to make it fit. Maybe that's one explanation of the Old Testament and Christ's death. But one thing that I think is very interesting, though, is that a lot of these people, a lot of his disciples, they fell away right before he was crucified. And I think, like, there are people today that die for their faith, like in Islam and stuff like that, and are martyred. But I think it's more crazy to think that people, because a lot of these authors, all these disciples, after they fell away in their unbelief, later on believed after he was resurrected. So I think it's crazier to think that people would go to their death and die, because many of these people were martyred afterwards in a lie. You know, because it makes sense that if you're going to make these things up, you know, not to like go through it with it, because they did have the chance to like fall away and stuff like that. So I just wanted to know what you thought about that. It's like dying lie.
I mean, that's a claim that you're making. It's not really a question, it's a claim. You're claiming that the disciples fell away and that basically then the writers, you know, came back and presenting the Gospels. But again, if you step back from the theological and the Christian viewpoint and look at it from the historical viewpoint and actually look at the text, that is where you will start to see where we're coming from. And I'm trying to keep that as brief and as respectful as I can. But the one point I will add is that the Gospels themselves, we don't even know who wrote them. I mean, the names that are ascribed to the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are not the writers. They weren't disciples. I know that's shocking for a lot of Christians. It's not taught. Your pastor's never going to tell you that we do not have a firsthand testimony of one of the disciples writing about Jesus' life. None of the Gospels.
The pizza has come. So,
real quick, I hope I wasn't offensive when I said I decided when I was younger to be an atheist because it was easier. I was an unresearched choice because I didn't want to feel guilt, like I grew up feeling. So I just want to make sure that
you didn't offend me.
Can I just add something? What I know the whole audience isn't here anymore, but what an incredibly thoughtful bunch of people you are, and we love questions, and even if it's afterwards, people that think through things are our favorite kind of people. You know, like the one guy in the Religulist that walked out the door. You're talking about my God, and he walked out the door. I appreciate everybody here that gets the dialogue. So I just wanted to mention that.
Let's give these guys a hand. We're going to break for lunch because I got to be back up here at 2. You guys are going to take in some of the different workshops, I understand. And, okay. And if you can catch them, if you still have a couple questions, I think you're hearing them say, hey, they're still open to dialogue before they jump into a session at 2 o'clock, all right? Thanks.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.